Today's Journey to Wellness in Indian Country is made possible by the University of Minnesota Medical School Duluth Campus, educating medical students dedicated to serving Minnesota and American Indian Alaska Native communities. Well, for a lot of people, transitions are really kind of tough to navigate, but our guest this morning is a man who's made an incredible transition, and he seems to be doing it and making it look not only easy, but a lot of fun. Herb Findae joins us this morning as our guest. Hi, Herb. Nice to have you with us.
Good morning.
So you were a police chief at Fond du Lac for many years. How did you originally come to wanting to do police work?
Well, I was growing up living around the Fond du Lac area. While I was going to high school, I actually considered law enforcement as a career. And as time went on, you know, some court cases come out, and Fond du Lac was able to start their own law enforcement department in, we'll say, 1998 because of the Minnesota Stone decision. And Fond du Lac had their police department up and running by 99. I was already enrolled at the Fond du Lac Tribal and Community College, so I went to school there, and I actually got hired by the police department in January of 2000. And from there, I went down to the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center, Indian Police Academy in Artesia, New Mexico. And I came back in June of 2000 that year, and I was working the road. I was on the street as a police officer. I was actually the third police officer ever hired by Fond du Lac.
Wow. So you did 20 years or so as a police officer, and then you retired and said, now what am I going to do? Or did you kind of know what you were going to do all along?
I kind of knew what I was going to do all along. You know, as time went on, and I was the chief of police, and you know, policing in this time of this this age, you know, it's quite difficult. So, you know, law enforcement is always getting a bad rap, and especially in Indian country, and you're working with governments, and you got Line 3 coming through, you got a lot of things that are happening, and you know, sometimes you think that you're fighting an uphill battle, and it's not just going how you want it to go. You know, in the struggle day in and day out, it took a toll on me, and it took a toll on my mind. And talking it through with my wife, and I've always been somebody that sews. I've been sewing for over 30 years. I've been perfecting my applique process for 12 of that, you know, and over time I was just sewing and making regalia and stuff for my family and myself. And and as time goes on, you know, people keep asking me if I could make some applique designs for them, make some powwow regalia for them, some applique ties, some applique shirts. And I said, sure, I can. So I started putting some stuff together, and the more and more of my work getting out there, I had more and more positive response, and people were asking me, and having a full-time job, it was just something I was not able to keep up with. And talking back and forth with my wife and I, you know, where I was saying that I could probably do this full time with all the orders that I got coming in. And if I actually, you know, committed myself to this, this is something where I could probably make a living. So we fast forward and to the times where I was the chief of police, and I said, I needed some self-healing too. So I woke up one morning and I said, and talked with my wife, and I said, I think it's time for me to retire and do this full time. She said, let's do it. So I did.
When you were working and you were coming home and sewing, did you feel that creativity, how did that creativity help you heal a little bit? Did the creativity help you heal a little bit? Was it kind of a something you could look forward to after a day of maybe seeing a lot of hard things or dealing with a lot of hard people? Was it something you really enjoyed to looking forward to?
I did. If I had a hard day at work and I'd come home, and it all depended on what type of project I was working on that time too. You know, if I was working on some ribbon skirts for my family, or if I was making regalia for myself or for our children. And also, you know, my wife's a jingle dress dancer, so I've made several of her jingle dresses. And for us, the wintertime, we're always preparing for the summer powwow season, and that's what we're doing. So I was always preparing for the next powwow season. And, you know, if you're a dancer on the powwow trail, we have this old saying is that our outfit is never, ever complete. We're always working on something. We're always adding to it. So, and that's what I was doing. And I look forward to that when I was getting off of work and I'd come home and I would just retire to my sewing machine and I would start working on something, whether it was a sewing project or a beading project or if I was putting some feathers together, you know, and it helped me a lot and prepared me for the next day and, you know, put me at ease and let me go back to work the next day. And it took off from there.
Wow. So now you are doing this full time, but you had to make a couple of modifications because you had gone, of course, from your kind of, you know, hobby cottage industry thing to doing this full time. You had to build a studio. You had to get some new equipment. Talk about that just a little.
Yeah. So my wife and I, we raise five children in our house. We have an 18-year-old daughter. She's since moved out. I have both of our boys live at home. We have a younger daughter that's three. She lives at home. And then I have a 10-year-old that lives with her mother, and she comes back and forth. But we had a large basement, and I had to build two rooms downstairs to accommodate. So I built those two rooms, and those two rooms took up my sewing space. And it shrunk down my sewing space to, like, maybe a 8x6 area. So it was really small. And I wasn't able to, you know, fit all my equipment in there comfortably, fit all my material in there comfortably. So when I decided that I was going to do this full time, I knew that I needed a larger space. And I had this cement concrete pad behind my house that measured 16 by 14 where a hot tub used to sit. And it had electricity run out to it for the hot tub. But it was just sitting there empty for years. And then I thought, well, that's someplace where I could build a studio if I wanted to. So in September came, I ordered the material, and I put my studio together. And it took me 17 days to put it together by myself.
That seems like a ridiculously short amount of time to build a studio.
Well, it was 17 working days, you know.
Right.
With the rain and you know, family time getting in there. It was right around a little over a month to do it, but it was 17 working days that it took me to put it up.
And imagine what you could have done if the three-year-old had been a little bit either older or more helpful.
Right.
Could have cut that time maybe in half. And then did you have to get new machinery too?
Yeah, so when I sew, I use two different types of sewing machines. I use a zigzag stitch machine, and I also use another machine that I use for all my decorative stitching. The machine that I use for the decorative stitching, it's gone bad on me right now. I need to get a new one, so I'm not able to use that as much. But I ordered a new machine that is much faster than all the home models that I've been using, and it's an industrial machine. And I researched for probably a month on what I was gonna purchase. And I ended up finding a machine called a Reliable, and I ordered it from Toronto, Canada. And that machine, it's a zigzag stitch machine, and that machine, it advertises of stitching 3,500 stitches per minute. So that increased my output time on doing my floral designs and all my applique, you know, and it sped it up by probably 5% faster.
Well, I got to ask you, though, if you're going from a home machine to 3,500 stitches per minute, what's the learning curve on a machine? You know, it's like, okay, am I going to lose my fingers on this deal or what?
Yeah, so there was a learning curve. And for my machine, I found out that I had to modify my presser foot that was on that machine. I took that out and I grinded it out and made it a little bit wider space so I'm able to see the actual designs that I'm working on while I'm sewing it. And also, and it wasn't something where I just jumped in and was able to zigzag stitch and create something beautiful out of it right away. I didn't start using it until probably right around November, December, and I ordered that. I had it in September, so there was probably 2 to 3 months of learning curve there before I actually started using it on my pieces.
Well, you've got to have a bunch of scrap material, and you've got to just use the darn thing until you figure out how it works. So tell me who the people are now. Who are your customers? And what are they buying?
I'm a large, we'll say the largest customer base I have is Indian country, the Native American community right now. And I'm getting orders from Canada. I've sent some stuff out to Maine, Oklahoma, Ohio. And my top selling piece is the velvet applique vest that I do. And I incorporate Ojibwe floral designs onto those. I'll incorporate some clan systems, some clan animals onto those. People will talk to me about their names that they carry, and with those names, I'll incorporate that onto the pieces also. And right now, that's what my top-selling piece is that velvet vest that I do. And I do those velvet vests in many different colors, from black, hunter green, a couple different reds. I've also ordered some plum and some different colors of green, too, and I'm going to probably be doing a purple one here in the next month or so. So the sky's the limit on those color options that I'm able to do with those velvet vests. And if somebody wants something that's going to match something or for a special occasion, I can do that.
Okay, so let me ask an ignorant but pertinent question.
Right.
Do you sell your beautiful works to non-Native people? And if non-Native people say, oh, that is such a beautiful vest or tie or ribbon skirt or fill in the blank, is that cultural appropriation?
I've been asked this question a few times, and there's many Native American Ojibwe designers all across the country right now. And I think it's important that we get our work out there, and that at some point it's going to become part of mainstream fashion. You see a lot of our women right now, a lot of women wearing the ribbon skirts out daily, and it's empowerment for them to wear those ribbon skirts daily, whether they're just going to a large business meeting or they're giving a presentation and they wear those ribbon skirts, and it adds to their persona, it adds to their feeling, which is great. And the more that those are seen out there in the public, the more people are going to ask about them, and the more people are going to want to wear those also. And I think at some point, our fashion is going to become mainstream, and you'll see everybody wearing our pieces. And I encourage everybody to wear our pieces. I encourage everybody to purchase one of my ties. I encourage them to purchase my formal vest and wear those and make it a part of, you know, their outfit, whether it's for a special occasion or not. And at some point, we'll get there, and I promote and I advocate for people to wear this, and not just in Indian country, but non-Native Americans alike too, to wear my designs.
So maybe you could put a little card in, so that if someone is wearing, you know, again, one of your pieces, and somebody comes up and says, "You're not Native. This is cultural appropriation." You kind of open up the vest or flip it over and say, look, I have like a permission slip from the artist. The artist said that he wants me to do this and that this is appropriate. Go ahead, please.
As we grow and move forward with this, you know, maybe that's something that we need to do, but at some point we're going to get to that point where we're not going to need that.
Exactly.
You know, and I've seen our geometrical designs that are out there right now, you know, and those were wearing over the past 5 years or so, they became very popular, and you could see them at local department stores across Duluth area, and those were being promoted as called Western wear, but, you know, they originated as Native American designs. And my thing is, if you're going to wear something like that, you know, at least support Native American artists while they're working and trying to make a living doing this, and, you know, because that's where it comes from. That's where it comes from, Indian country, and our designs are beautiful, and we have them out there, and the more you see them, everybody loves them. You know, and I talk about our floral designs. The floral designs are not ours. They're given to us. They're a gift from the Creator, and that's how we make all of our beadwork, all of our art. It just comes from what we're seeing when we're just walking around and we're enjoying our woodland lifestyle.
Well, Herb, what a joy it's been to talk with you this morning. And what a success story, too, about a person who made a transition and found something that works as well or maybe better in some ways. That's always a handy thing to think about. If I had to make a transition, how could I make it a really healthy one? And I think you're a great role model for that as well. Thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Herb Findae this morning, our guest here on 103.3 KUMD. He is a retired police officer and chief of police, and he's the owner of Round Lake Traditions. Today's Journey to Wellness in Indian Country is made possible by the University of Minnesota Medical School Duluth Campus, a national leader in improving health care access and outcomes in rural Minnesota and American Indian, Alaska Native communities.